This is the Radio Walensky Podcast. I'm Richard Walensky with new and archive interviews from the Probabilities and Bookwaves Art Waves programs on KPFA-FM and Pacifica Syndication. My guest is Lauren Gunderson, who is the most produced contemporary playwright in America in 4 out of the last 5 years. Georgiana and Kitty, Christmas at Pemberley, co-written with Margot Melkon, is at TheaterWorks, Lucy Stern Theater, that's in Palo Alto, December 3rd through 28. We have Ada and the Engine, which runs through December 7th at The Pearl in Mountain View. Louisa Alcott's Little Women, played also at TheaterWorks earlier this fall, and will be at the Portland Center Stage through December 21st. But we're also here to discuss a play called Muse of Fire. That will run at the Magic in Fort Mason Center in San Francisco, directed by Evren Chicken. It's an exploration of Shakespeare's loves, and you are performing in it. And this follows on the heels of another play about Shakespeare, The Book of Will. What is bringing you to Muse of Fire? How much is written? Where are you on that?
It is a play that's had about 6 workshops all over the world, actually. We were just in Prague at the Prague Shakespeare Company, and it's coming to the Magic September 22nd to October 11th, 2026. This is a subject that has sort of been evergreen for me ever since I was a kid reading Julius Caesar in my bedroom. I have been sort of in a conversation with Shakespeare, like so many theater proficients are and professionals. You don't get very far in this ambition without crossing Shakespeare, contending with Shakespeare, adoring Shakespeare. And so I sort of have all of that in my repertoire. I've written about Shakespeare a bunch, a lot of riffs on Shakespeare, especially the comedies Taming of the Shrew and a new one that's premiering next year, both in Wisconsin and in Florida and other places, a play called Lady Disdain, which is a riff on Much Ado About Nothing, set in the world of romantasy audiobook narrators. But the Muse of Fire is one that was this very special. It's a two-hander for starters, which is very hard to write and very hard to sustain. And it's a bit brazen to write a two-hander at all, much less one about the greatest poet in the English language and his wife. So it really was an exploration of her that I was most excited about. I frankly see myself in both of those characters, both the playwright struggling to balance the work and family and distance and truth and art, and of course the woman at home who is deeply connected to the children and the schedules and not the city life and the more domestic sphere, but also having this, you know, raging, pumping heart that has something to say and has something to give the world and tell the world. So both of those felt very, very writable to me. And it's been a really interesting and unique process developing this play. And I'm really thrilled to launch it very soon.
When you're developing the play, how does that development start? Do you just sit down and scribble? At what point does a dramaturg come in? And we're talking specifically about a play that right now is not going to be the play that's in the Magic next year because it's still in transition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it'll be in transition up until opening night. So it certainly always is. I mean, these ideas start at generating as much of the script as I can, as quickly as I can. I mean, it's not a play until it has an end. So you have to get all the way through that first draft, as shaky or as abbreviated as it might be, until you have a thing. And then that thing is what gets workshopped and read 1,000 times and explored with my colleagues and dissected with the director, Evren. And, you know, it really becomes a collective thing. And, you know, this one was special because this cohort of people who are working on it, we were all in the Google Doc together when we were workshopping it. So it wasn't like it usually is in play development processes where, you know, there's a paper script and I give you new pages with new rewrites. We were working so fast and so collectively that it would, as we would have ideas or questions would come up, or we want to try something, I would just say, can you give me, you know, 5 minutes? I would rewrite it. Everyone would refresh the Google Doc, and then we have a new script. So it was that sort of speed and propulsion that really allowed us to get the play this far. The play is, you know, barely a year old, less than that from when I first started. Although I had the idea for a very long time that I wanted to write a story about Will and Anne, but obviously some versions of their story had been told in a lot of different ways. But this one felt really ripe for a sharp, beautiful two-hander that can really explore, you know, the heart of creatives and, you know, what it means to be a part of something big and theatrical, but also something intimate and pure. And so that's sort of what we were working on.
You didn't quite have a script when you had your first Zoom meeting. Is that more or less what I'm sensing?
Oh, no. I don't ever send it out until there's an actual script, for sure. All the way through, you have to write the thing. And I really didn't tell anybody or show it to Everin until we had a full play. Because, you know, half a play is not a play. A third of a play is not a play. The idea of a play is not a play. We need the script. We need entrance and exits. We need sculpture, we need humor and tone, and that really sort of isn't, you can't just sort of theorize that, you need to prove it. So the first script, you know, was very similar to what we have now and what you'll see at the Magic, but also different in many, many ways. The characters took a lot of different diversions and pushed them in different directions. It's a lot deeper, it's a lot grittier, it's a lot more beautiful and strange and surprising. But I really wanted it to be sort of a portrait of a marriage, a portrait of the complexities of knowing someone for a long time and all the emotions that Shakespeare writes about. I sort of wanted to say, oh, this is where he got a lot of that. And it's quite a joy to write in that space, and a challenge. I mean, it's a bit brazen to do it, for sure. So having or at least pretending to have the confidence to give words to William Shakespeare was hard but exciting.
When you're working on it with Everin, who's the director, are you thinking at that point ever about stage directions?
Oh, sure. Yes. Stage directions are, as if more important than any line, because they're going to tell you the truth about what the characters are actually doing and feeling and the lies they're telling and the hopes they have. So everything is on the page. Entrance, exits, every sort of emotional coloring of a line. If one of the characters is lying, I will tell you in the stage direction. If they are flirting, I'll tell you in the stage direction. If they are furious, I'll tell you, much less what they're doing gesturally or how we start and set a scene. Where do we meet these characters? What kind of entrance do they have? Just walking in casually is different than hurrying in. So all of these things are the tools that playwrights have to really make sure that the actor knows, whenever they are inheriting this script, long after I'm stopped being involved, what exactly is happening, because humanity is very distinct, it's very specific, and it's very nonverbal. So those stage directions are critical for understanding and having an elegant and humanistic, organic play, as opposed to something that feels clunky and overly expositional and melodramatic.
Would that be the same process then for the three Pemberley plays, as well as, say, Little Women?
Every play has that requirement, where a play is so much more than the lines that you hear spoken. It is about the entire portrait of each character. It is the countenance. It is the contrast and complement of characters' personalities and the pace and their senses of humor, and all of that stuff are the things that we also create. Those are not accidents that happen on the stage. So it's very fun. The Pemberley plays are so wonderful for me to see over and over again. I mean, they've been around for a decade now, which is very exciting. And Margot and I, that was such a wonderful collaboration with her. And we have, what's fun is we're going to have a big release of a new Miss Bennett offering shortly. I can't really say too much about it, but it should be coming out very, very soon. So, a new version of that is widely accessible of the place.
Why update it then?
It's not an update of the script. It's just a different version. It's not a version that changes the words, but a different media version whole.
Is Miss Bennett at this point your most produced play, you think?
I don't think so. I think it's probably Silent Sky, which is always in production all around the world. INU is close. And these days, The Revolutionists, people are doing a ton of productions of that, I think, because the anger over the administration, channeling it into a play about women challenging a revolution is pretty on point. So
you're also going to be performing. Now, if I recall correctly from our interview about the Catastrophist of, I guess, 4 or 5 years ago, that you started out as an actor, remember correctly. Have you done any acting since?
No, not very much. The occasional reading, the, you know, occasional sort of one night event, but this is a chance to find this role. I mean, you know, for me, having adored Shakespeare for so much of my life, the idea of being in a story where I can stand on stage with Shakespeare is is pretty exciting in general. But to be able to tell this story where I sort of feel like I have not caught up to Shakespeare, but I could have a conversation with him about this strange, bizarre career that we find ourselves in. And so right. It feels in some ways like I could play either role really well, actually. but it seems like most expected for me to play Anne.
When you're an actor and Evren is directing you on the stage and you object to something he's said, as an actor, you're going to do what the director says. As the playwright, you're going to tell the director what would work. How do you work that out?
Well, good news is Evren is such a pro and happens to be a very good trusted friend. So he's great at going, this is a note for playwright Lauren and this is a note for actor Lauren. And, you know, the rooms that he runs as a director are so collaborative and kind and very clear. I mean, he's so smart and so clear with his vision that you will always know what he's thinking. So there's no mystery, and that allows me to be very clear in what I'm thinking. And, you know, and yes, it is a strange relationship to be able to work with an actor that can also go, you know what, I'm going to cut that line. I don't like it. not too many actors actually get to do that, but I do.
How did Ada and the Engine come about?
You know, that as a couple years ago, that one actually started in the Bay Area as well, and has had a long, happy legacy so far, many, many years on many, many stages. So it's really lovely to see it. That is a story that comes to me from my sort of love of investigating the history of women and the history of science and the history of great, brilliant people. And this one was a particular combination of both, because it is certainly a portrait of Ada Lovelace, who was one of the original computer programmers before there were computers. This is, her father was the famous poet Lord Byron. So this is that era of English history, but also Charles Babbage, who created the difference engines and the analytical engines, which were the early prototypes for computers. So their partnership, their relationship, the support and friendship between them has always been really, really interesting to me. And so that was an easy and fun and exciting and kind of musical play to write. There's a musical twist at the end, which is really lovely. And so,
speaking of musicals, you've also worked on a musical called The Time Traveler's Wife. What happened with that?
Yeah, so it was on the West End in 2023. We enjoyed a lovely run. It was really interesting. I mean, taking one of my very favorite books of all time and turning it into a musical with a wonderful West End producer, incredible cast. So it was great. And the music was by the wonderful Dave Stewart of the Eurythmics and Joss Stone, just two icons of music and pop and rock. So that was quite an honor. The music is great.
Laura Gunderson, in terms of writing something that will survive long after the current regime, yet wanting to be contemporary, can you pull that off? How do you pull that off?
I mean, the truth is what we're seeing is both invigoratingly and infuriatingly specific to our time and also a very old playbook. So in some ways, the artist's job is to recognize the pattern and to name the pattern. And so sometimes we write plays not about the moment we're in, but about the future or about the long past as a way to talk about this moment. So I think we will start to see that. It is also very hard to truly write about the moment that you're in without relying a lot on a journalistic kind of theater, which is incredible. And the people who do it, I have massive respect for. I am not one. so there is a lot that I, when I write a lot of political pieces, which truly every piece is political, even just the Pemberley plays are political. If you cast it with diversity and you see those family on stage that represents the community that they're in, sharing and centering different people than you would normally see, especially than you see in power right now. That is a political act. Getting people together to have an empathetic and happy evening, or a curious evening, or a challenging evening in the theater together, focusing on art and not their phones and not the president. That is an important and artistically activist, even if the play seems sweet and delightful. Little Women is an activist play. That play is set during a world, during a civil war, with a plague that is killing people all across America, people violently fighting each other and disagreeing on fundamental forms, a nation ripped in half. This is very reasonable and recognizable, unfortunately, in this moment in time. And what is also recognizable is strong women defending and standing up for themselves and standing up for their family, and great, wonderful, tender men who support them, love them, and understand them. So all of that is an activist form, even though it's from a book from over 150 years ago.
The other part of that goes back to the casting decisions, because in something more contemporary, you have to watch out, or in something that's kind of, quote, real, you're not necessarily going to have multiple races playing father and daughter, let's say. But if you're going through history and playing it a certain way, you can do that.
And in fact, it does a better job of what theater is trying to do, which is to reflect the community. It's not about, an accuracy that would be dismissive or not allow people to take part in the storytelling. That's more important than any of that. So yes, I'm always a fan of as many people as we can get on stage that look like the community and the world. That is certainly better. And, you know, part of that presumption is just, you know, it's a longstanding, you know, history of white people in power in the theater. And anything we can do to sort of shake that loose is great, and to envelop that into the accuracy and the warmth of the community that we're representing and we're trying to reach.
A few years ago, ACT did a production of Ah Wilderness, and a salesman was played by a Black person walking into a home in 1910 Indiana, in a white home. And it struck me that that doesn't take into account what was actually happening race-wise in Indiana. It seems easier in Little Women. How do you try to balance those particular elements?
I think we're telling the best version of the story for that community and for the priority there. So our job is not to reflect everything. Now, it's also a bit of self-selection. There are actors who don't want to be in those reimagined versions because of exactly what you're talking about. And we have to take that into consideration, have those complex and important conversations. But right now, Little Women is being performed all over the U.S. in a lot of different ways. City Theater is in a sold out and already extended production of that same script with a beautiful, diverse cast there. The Portland Center Stage cast is amazing. I've already heard people in the audiences say, I've never seen a Joe with braids before. There's a beautiful Black woman with braids who's playing Joe. And it's an incredible thing to say. Like, that's worth way more than, well, in 1910, it would actually have been. Like, who cares? I want people to walk out inspired and affected and saying, I see myself on stage. That's way more important than the well, actually, you know, factual accuracy. That's what documentaries are for. That's what Ken Burns is for. For the theater, we are to expand and live into abundance and live into diversity.
Part of that for me is that I think 15 years ago, I might have been going, seriously? Now it's become so standard, it's completely changed. And I guess people like Lauren Gunderson are partly responsible for changing how we look at theater.
Yeah, well, certainly not me alone, but I am very much a fan of casting that is as welcoming and supportive as we can absolutely make it.
Laura Gunderson, let me ask you about how theaters curate seasons, because it's changed. The subscribership in Bay Area since the pandemic is something like 30 to 40% off from what it was pre-pandemic. And that has forced theaters to go to war horses rather than new plays in order to bring the audience in. What are your thoughts about what's happening in local theaters, in community theaters at this point?
I don't run a theater, so I don't know. What I am seeing from the outside is a trend of balancing, supporting new and important and critically investigative and challenging and edgy plays with what will sell tickets. And sometimes those are the same thing, and hallelujah when that is the case. And sometimes the audiences need to be welcomed back with something that is an easy purchase. And that is something that requires some sort of easy buy-in. Often it's a known title. The reason why Little Women is selling out is less because of me and more because of the title of Little Women and Louisa May Alcott. Now we're doing something really fun and really fresh and theatrical and something that I'm incredibly proud of as a writer. So that one sort of straddles both. It's a bit of a new play and a bit of a classic. And that's a great thing for audiences to be able to buy in. But also when they go, feel like they really saw something new and exciting and something of that theater. At this point, it is whatever's keeping the theaters afloat. What is employing actors? What is employing designers? I think we're still, oddly specifically in the Bay Area, in a season of feeling like we're not giving the audience what they want, or we're not making it as easy for them to come back as they want. I don't know why. Again, I don't run the theaters, and I'm not looking at the actual subscriber numbers and patterns, but just based on terms of the conversations that I'm having as a commissioned playwright, as a playwright that's widely produced, seeing that some of the plays of mine are fitting in that slot of this is an easy buy, it's a comfort buy, it is something that, you know, our Georgiana and Kitties, our Miss Bennett's, our Little Women, Silent Skies, those fit a sort of a certain lane where you're going to get something smart, you're going to get something feminist, and you're going to get something you can take your grandma to. And all of that together makes for an easy purchase. So I think what we have to do is make sure that we are still investing in young artists and brave new voices. That is going to be the thing that over the long run will keep us the strongest as an art form. And we also have to be very practical about what are the things that get the audiences and keep the audiences. And, you know, there's a lot of theaters who are actually doing quite well right now. So having conversations with them about what patterns they're doing and the theaters that are struggling, we have to figure out how to have their back, how to save them, how, what needs to change or adjust or what have you to really make this sustainable.
Here in the Bay Area, I know certain theaters are doing better than others, but there's always been an issue with bringing in younger people to begin with. I mean, that goes back to when I first started dealing with theater over 20 years ago. It's been an ongoing issue. From your perspective, is it getting better? Or are audiences getting younger now, you think?
I mean, are any of us getting younger? No. Yes and no. It depends on what theater. Like some of the theaters are going to continue to have a sort of theater season that appeals to a certain age group or a certain experience level. Like sometimes if you're doing plays about mortgages, like 20-year-olds don't care. But I just came from the Rogue Machine Theater in LA. They did the US premiere of my play, Anthropology, which will be coming to City Lights Theater in San Jose next year as well. That one is a crazy AI-based feminist mystery thriller. I'm very excited that Lisa Millett's doing that one. But down in LA, they had, you know, my play on the main stage, which was getting some great audiences. But then upstairs, they had this crazy tiny little play that was set in a girl's room, and you like sat on the bed with the actors and all of the youngest people that I've ever seen in a theater going to that play. So you got to give them something they want. I mean, the expectation that like, we'll keep doing the plays that we want and you're just supposed to come is not going to be something certainly that any 25-year-old is going to want to do. It's got to be cool. It's got to be, you know, intriguing and smart and some reason to take me off my phone and to, I think also respond to the way that they're buying tickets, which is often last minute. It's what you want to do tonight, not what do you want to do in 3 months and which row do you want to sit in and go ahead and pre-order your drinks for 3 months from now. I don't know what 3 months is. So this last minute stuff, and I'm certainly guilty of that. I just bought a ticket right before we got here to a play on Friday, which is 2 days away. So I've just grabbed one and had the free night. So I'm of that spirit as well, for good or ill. And I love theater and I go to everything I can. And still I'm like, don't make me buy a ticket 3 months from now.
Laura Gunderson, you wrote the screenplay for Lightyear. That's one Pixar film. You've not done any others. Are you interested in screenplays? How did that work?
I was one of the many, many writers on that script. So I certainly do not take credit for the whole of it, but I got to learn a ton about writing for animation when I was there and really loved working there. It was a very cool project to be a part of, but I was not the final writer, and there was many writers before and after me, which is generally how it works, certainly in animation, but in a lot of Hollywood movies, there's one of many writers. I loved it. I mean, those projects are very distinct from theater because, boy, do they take a long time. They're very collective. The writer is, it's not really the writer's vision usually, it's the director's vision. And so that is something that's different in the theater, where it's really, the first productions are certainly my brainchild, my gravity that is bringing this thing into being. So there's a lot more about the playwright's vision and voice, of course, supported and investigated and augmented and everything by the director and all the designers and the actors and everything. It's very collective, of course, but there's a sort of, you know, buck stops with the playwright, which is different than in Hollywood. So I love writing for screen. I love all forms of storytelling, and certainly something I love, new forms that I don't have as much experience with. I love learning and trying something 1,000 times and trying something new. And so that was certainly that.
Have you ever wanted to do a libretto for an opera?
Not really. Yeah. I mean, maybe. It depends on the music. I do like opera. I like it very much. But that hasn't been something that I've explored. But I do love, love, love writing music. I have a new musical that I have for the first time written both book lyrics and music for. So that is going to be really exciting. That one's a commission for a DC area theater company that will be starting its launch next year as well.
Oh, and you have a composer you're working with then?
I do. I have a composer. I have the melodies and the songs are mine, but I'm working with one of my very favorite collaborators on that to give the fullest vision and to really explore it.
You have a podcast, How to Playwright. When you're talking to prospective playwrights, what do you see as the most important thing you can tell them, the general advice?
I would say two things. One, go see a lot of plays. Go see all the plays and all the plays you can. Read as many plays as you can. That is really how you're going to get the fullest experience, because plays don't live on the page. They don't stop. They're not a literary form solely. They are live and they are performative. So we need to see what it's like off the page, heard in space and time, the musicality of it, the breathing, the bodies. So seeing the plays. And the second thing is focusing or allowing yourself to wander to the end as quickly as possible. Because the truth is, I like to say sort of brazenly that anyone can write the first 20 or 30 pages of a play, but the last 20, 30 pages of the play is what makes you a playwright. So that's really the puzzle solving required to make sure that script gets exactly where you want it and the audience leaves with a version of what you want. The character is resolved, contended, affected, and realized at the end. Is that's the point. That's the hard work. That's why it's difficult and why a lot of us have lots of degrees. That's generally what I try to start with. But yes, the podcast has been really, really fun. I love the response that I've been getting, and I'm able to just sort of ramble, which is my favorite subject, is playwriting, dramatic structure, sort of the humanity and architecture of story. So yes, I'm happy to talk about it all the time and on the podcast again.
Well, that comes back to something I've noticed doing reviews is that second act problem.
Yes.
You come to the end of Act One, and there may or may not be intermission, but at that moment you're going, wow, this thing is fabulous. And then comes Act Two and crash. Is there a way to avoid that, or is it just simply puzzle solving?
No, the Act Two problem is if your midpoint is strong enough. So usually the midpoint, well, always the midpoint. So it happens right at that middle part. It's often right before the intermission if there is one. But if there's not, it's that middle moment where something changes so drastically for the main character. Something is altered, some choice is made that is irreversible, that has to not just complicate, but propel the main character's action through Act Two. This is true in movies. This is true in, I think, in novels. It's a little bit of a different structure just because they take many forms and can take a bit longer to tell the story than the 2 hours traffic of our stage. But the second act is about making sure that the momentum of the first act is retained and then actually escalated. And that is largely because the second act needs to drive the main character to a point where they have to make a character-defining decision and choice and action. And that can, if it's too subtle, feel like nothing is happening. So you have to give over from, you know, you have to achieve the promise, give the audience what you've promised them. And a lot of that is when we come to wrapping the story up instead of making the point, what did it all amount to? Who did it? Are they going to get together? Is the problem solved? Can be a place for people to sort of step back away from a big choice when what Shakespeare tells us is you got to go towards the big choice. You got to knock it out of the park at the second act. If you take your foot off the gas and get thoughtful or get somber, then boy, it's snooze fest. So you have to keep things going, even more than the first act, because we're paying attention in the first act in the way that we're not in the second. Now we're like, well, what is it? What's happening? What's going on? Who's in charge? What does it all mean? When is this over? So having to have almost the pacing go up more when sometimes we want to like take a step back. So go forth and make big choices all the way to the end.
What I've noticed is a lot of these plays that are strong first acts and weak second, the humor disappears in act two.
And yes, don't do that. Be funny. I mean, part of it is what an act two wants is for that midpoint is such a complicating factor that often it takes what is has levity in the first act and makes it very serious. And that is where we start to not joke, because now the character is put in a whole new situation that is taxing, that is stressful, that is demanding, which can take the tone down into like, okay, now we're serious. But whatever tone you have in act one, you can continue it in act two, but you need to sort of decide on what sort of genre braiding you are doing and do it confidently and with intention. So it's not accidentally not funny, but intentionally not funny.
Right now, since Wicked for Good just opened, we can look at that as act one was one thing, and then act two is something else. The problem is that people expect act one in act two, but it's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm. That is true. That's true. Yes, the love stories are always quite delightful and fun in the first part and then get serious with the consequences in the second part. So we have to be able to have it be one story, but also continue what is so, you know, magnetic about whatever act one is doing.
When you're at that point for you as a playwright, having done so many plays, is the problem that you haven't thought through the consequences, or are you thinking of the consequences before you get to that point where the character changes at the end of act one?
Oh, yeah. I plan out pretty much everything. So I don't really start writing until I know a version of an ending, which includes that midpoint, because everything's connected. It's all one gesture. It's not like you can sort of write this without writing that or know this without knowing that. You can, but it'll take you three times as long to write the thing if you don't know all the bits. So I certainly know. Now I'm always surprised in every, you know, scene that I'm writing. I get there and go, oh, I didn't know they were going to talk about that, or what an interesting idea. I'll follow that, or oh, that's something great. I have to plant in act two or in act one and use in act two. So I'm always learning and exploring in the scene, but I definitely have a sort of direction and such.
When you are working on a play at this point and just starting out, how scary is that moment?
Tossing the idea over and over and over is something I don't do with my fingers hovered over a keyboard. I do that while walking around London or talking to my friends and colleagues, or, you know, pacing or just doing laundry and doing normal human things. I'm sort of always replaying and teasing the idea out so that when I do sit down, it's very exciting for me to sit down, because I know that like, oh, we're going to start something. And when they start these things, I finish them. And here we go. Here's another whole that, you know, 2 years from now, a year from now, I'll be sitting in a rehearsal room because of what I'm starting right now. and that is a thrilling feeling. It's never not exciting. I sort of think of it like that. It's less, you know, again, a play doesn't want to stay on the page. So when I'm done, it's not like, great, I print it out and I sort of look at it. That is the beginning of the invitation to colleagues and people I trust and love to work with to come together and start to make something really special out of this. But that coming together doesn't happen until I finish the damn thing, which doesn't happen until I start the damn thing. So
you have deadlines, which I guess helps a little bit.
Yes. And some are imposed. A lot of them are imposed. Nobody asks me to write half the stuff I write. I just do. So it works out, but I love a good deadline, and I don't like to see time passing without having written something that matters to me.
Lauren Gunderson, how many plays do you have in various stages going on your computer right now?
Oh my gosh. Well, what a great question. I can literally count. Let's see. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. A dozen just in my Google Docs on right here. But I do have a list, and so all post-its of all the different ideas that are yet to come that I am telling myself I have to write. So those are forthcoming as well.
How about research on historical plays? At what point do you sit there and go, I need to know stuff?
Mm-hmm. I mean, most of the research before I start and sort of inhale everything, and then only look at it if I need a detail, like you mentioned. Oh, I need to know what they were wearing back then, or what they would drink for breakfast, or, you know, those sorts of details I can snoop out. But a lot of it is just sort of indulging in the world and really sort of inundating myself in research to figure out what feels. A lot of it is just getting tone and some specifics. But I mean, the truth is, with every historical play, like, I'm not going to write something unless I really feel like the characters have a contemporary spirit, because they do. I mean, humans are humans no matter what century that they're in. And so a lot of the things that we write plays about are the things that are going to be actually common, you know, life and death and love and betrayal and, you know, triumph and tragedy. These are things that are, that's what Shakespeare wrote. That's what we're writing right now. So it's not like life was so different back then for a human. Like, it was different, but the human part is actually similar. There's several plays of mine where I sort of tell the story of working on the Book of Will, which, you know, has several people die in the play and talks about death a lot. And, you know, one of the actors was kind of saying, yes, you know, people died so much more frequently back then and much younger. And so, you know, maybe losing, you know, a bunch of kids you would sort of expect to, and it wasn't quite as painful. And our director was like, no, losing a kid's losing a kid. Like, we can't pretend like, well, they're immune to, well, another kid, I'll just throw this one away. Like, no, that's your child. It's going to feel that same gutting loss, whether it's right now or 400 years ago. And so that's the only way to write, and the only reason to write about the history is because it's still us. We still see ourselves in it. So that is kind of a mantra of mine when I write about history. It's like, they're us just hundreds of years ago.
When I talk to novelists, they talk about how characters take over. They talk about how it almost feels like they're channeling something. Does that happen with you writing plays?
Sort of. It feels like it's more of a curiosity that I can't quell until I get to the end. It's not like I'm following a character or, you know, listening to them, you know, speak and I type. It is more structural for me. There is a puzzle solving to it that I really long to sort of know what happens in the end. Yeah. And so I follow that curiosity. The problem solving part of my brain just kind of won't rest until we've got to the end and we've got some version of it. But the truth is that really what happens is in those first few workshops, like, that's when I know if the play is working, not when I, again, have the script done and I've read it out loud to myself. But now that we have actors lifting it off the page and we have conversations with directors, dramaturgs, and the people that I trust, now we can see what we're dealing with. What kind of play is it? How fast does it go? How funny is it? How funny is it supposed to be? you know, how poetic? How much can we do in silence versus sound? There's a lot of space to figure out how this play is particularly beautiful or strange or surprising. So that's really what I long to do, again, is finish the thing so that I can get in the room and then we really start writing.
I saw a play at Berkeley Rep, everybody talking in very thick accents. I have bad hearing. The audience is older, and I couldn't understand half the play. As a playwright, when you're writing plays where people have accents, how do you deal with that?
I don't know. I don't. That's really less of my purview than a director or a dialect coach. or even a dramaturg sometimes can help pinpoint an accent, but I don't know.
Because of my hearing, and I wonder if this is something that would help a playwright. I see a play, and then if I can, because I have to review it and I've missed some stuff, I get people to send me the PDF. And then I relive the play in my head. What that does is it does a couple of things. Number one, it fills in the gaps. But number two, it shows me after the fact what exactly the director and actor choices were. And it changes my view. What do you think about that?
Well, I'm curious, how does it tend to change your view?
Because I can see the choices that they made.
That might be like not scripted or something different from what is on the script versus what you saw, and finding the differences and the similarities.
And if you go the other way and say, read the play and then do that, I don't think you get the play because you sort of need to see the play first.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I like that.
Laura Gunderson, in all of the plays that you've seen, if you could pick out a play that you wish you had written, what would it be?
Oh my gosh, what an impossible question. I mean, I'm going to say Hamlet because, I don't know, it sounds like it's a pretty good one. I also spent the most time inside of that play, looking at that play, contending with it, debating with it, adoring it. So I'm going to kind of go basic and say Hamlet.
You've been listening to an interview with playwright Lauren Gunderson. Georgiana and Kitty, Christmas at Pemberley, plays through December 28th at TheaterWorks Lucy Stern Theater in Palo Alto. For more information, you can go to theaterworks.org. Ada and the Engine plays at the Pear Theater in Mountain View through December 7th. And for more information on that, you can go to thepear.org. And Muse of Fire will play at the Magic in Fort Mason Center next September 22nd through October 11th in a production directed by Evren Odchicken that features Lauren Gunderson in her first acting job since she became a full-time playwright. Until next time, I'm Rich Walensky. Radio Walensky usually posts every week on Sundays. You can write to me either at bookwaves@hotmail.com or richard@kpfa.org. You can find other Radio Walensky podcasts in the Area 941 section of kpfa.org, or you can go to bookwaves.homestead.com or richardwalensky.com for a complete listing of all digitized recordings. You can subscribe to Radio Walensky via iTunes or follow Richard Walensky Radio Shows on Facebook.